Well, happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day, Tim.
That's right.
Did anyone come early to enjoy the breakfast that they had here at the church this morning? Yeah, that's good. Now, question for those who didn't, I gotta ask, did you prepare a breakfast for your moms at home? Or did your moms prepare a breakfast for you? Or did you just forget all together that it was Mother's Day and it just kind of went with it? Could be any one of the cases. Well, each Mother's Day, I take Sarah. I take her and I set her down and I say, Sarah, it's Mother's Day. And I said, today, I don't want you to worry about the laundry. I don't want you to worry about the dishes, how clean the house is. I just want you to just put those things off of your mind and not worry about a thing. Because all of those things will be here waiting for you tomorrow. And that's just one of those things that's very meaningful for her. We have this moment. She loves it when I do that. You know, Mother's Day, you think of it, okay, like when you're in school, elementary school, and I know the kids have done it because our kids have done it here too. In elementary school, what happens is all of the teachers get together and they create all these wonderful projects for kids to create. They're art teachers that make things out of clay. They're classroom teachers that make this, that, and the other thing. And then they wrap them up in, you know, newspaper or what have you, bags, and they present them then to mothers on Mother's Day. Well, you notice, you know, school's done at the end of May. And so Father's Day comes around and, you know, what do we get? Nothing. If anything was made in school, by that time the clay is broken and you get a bag full of clay chips. I remember, you know, when I was growing up, you know, Mother's Day, we always had things. We made them in school and we presented them to Mom on Mother's Day. And when Father's Day rolled around, what we would do, my brother and I, we'd go into our pigeon-infested barn and we'd pull out an old bicycle. And we'd take the bicycle out, we'd take the air pump, and we'd pump up the tires, which would hold air for about 15 seconds. We would spray it off with a hose, we'd throw a little WD-40 on the chain, and we'd give it, here, Dad, we fixed this up for you. And that was our Father's Day present to him. Quite a contrast compared to what we do for Mother's Day. And I don't mind. I really don't mind. But it's a contrast that my dad had to suffer through for many, many years. So I'd like you to encourage you today, especially moms, but really this is going to apply to all of us. What we're going to encounter today is this challenge, this encouragement, what it looks like to actually find rest. You know, Mother's Day is one of those days that we set aside, and what is designed to happen is it's supposed to be finally this one day of the year that ends up being a day of rest for moms. Supposed to be. Oftentimes, if you have young children, moms, you know that this is just not the case. And Mother's Day is a little bit of a farce when it comes to this idea of this was supposed to be my day of rest because maybe the kid's father is not investing any time. Well, you're not my mom. You know, well, has he called his mom? No, probably not yet. Okay. So if you're a father here and you have not wished your wife a happy Mother's Day, shame on you. You should do that. And if you're a father here and you have not called your mother, if it's at all possible, you should call your mom before the day is over. But anyhow, we're dealing with this idea of today is supposed to be a day of rest for moms. It's a Sabbath, in fact. And as we look at scriptures, we oftentimes look at and we see the Sabbath is notified. It's recognized as this day of rest for God's people. And it's something that's designed to point back to him. And so we have this picture. And I hope that you grasp this idea of what we're going to look at here today, because we're going to find Jesus is going to be confronted right where we left off last time. Jesus is going to be confronted with, hey, you're breaking the rules of the Sabbath. And so what happened was, you remember back a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about, this was the week before Youth Sunday, we're talking about Jesus comes to the table and he presents two healings. He's back up in the northern area of Israel. He's in the area, the region of Galilee. And as he comes to Galilee, there's this man, there's this ruler, I should say it's an authority from the Roman Empire. Okay, and he was an official for Herod's ruling. And he goes up to Jesus because he heard about the things that Jesus does. And he says to Jesus, Jesus, my son is extremely sick. I mean, he's sickened to the point of death. Will you come with me to heal him? And Jesus challenges the people in Galilee. He says, unless you guys see a sign, you're never going to believe. You know, you're so focused on what you get out of this stuff. And you're not looking at any kind of faith. And this Roman official says, Jesus, please, please come. Jesus speaks the word. He says, your son's going to be okay. And so the man goes off and he finds out that exactly at that moment that Jesus said, your son will live, that this son was healed. And this Roman official had great faith. And then the next section of the scripture we find in John chapter 5, what we find is Jesus encounters this, it's called an invalid. There's this man sitting at these pools in the city of Jerusalem, right near the temple. And the belief was that when these pools were stirred, it was kind of a superstition. There may have been some truth behind the superstition that perhaps some had experienced some form of healing when these pools were stirred. But when these pools were stirred, when there was ripples in the water, the first one into the pool then would be healed. And so Jesus confronts him. He finds that there's this man who's been sitting at this pool for 38 years. And he's been waiting for this opportunity when those waters stirred to be able to be the first one in. And time after time, year after year, he sits there and he waits only to find that whenever the waters are stirred, he's never the first one in because there's no one to ever help him into the pool. Jesus comes up to him and he says, "Do you want to be well?" And the man, you can tell, there's this tone that comes from him. It's like, "Yeah, what do you think? You know, I've been here for 38 years. You tell me, do you think I want to be well?" And Jesus says to him, he says, "Take up your mat and walk." And what we're going to find here this morning, this is where we're taking it off here from. So Jesus says to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And once the man was cured, he picked up his mat and he walked. And this is the part we neglected to include last time we got together because we're going to deal with it today. This is what it says. The day on which this took place was the Sabbath. And then in this culture, what Jesus has just done is really a double no-no. First thing he does is he heals a man. So in other words, Jesus is doing this work, if you will, on this day of rest. And then he, in fact, is telling this man, "Take up your mat and walk." And so the man picks up his yoga mat. Okay. Probably didn't have yoga mats back then. It's probably, you know, some other form. But they had this mat, okay? So he was laying down on his mat. And afterwards, Jesus said, "Take up your mat and walk." So he took it. Maybe he folded it. Maybe he rolled it. But he ends up, he's taking this mat. It wouldn't have been very large enough that he could carry wherever he went. So he takes up this mat and he begins to walk. And then as he walks, he's going to be confronted by some Jewish rulers. Now look at what happens here. So the Jewish leaders said to the man, this man who's walking with his mat, he's just been healed, okay? He had been an invalid for 38 years. Now he's walking around. He's been healed. People would have recognized him. People would have known him. He's walking around with his mat. The Jewish leaders say, "Hey, wait a minute. What are you doing carrying your mat on the Sabbath?" That's the other no-no that Jesus has just done. Not only did he heal this man, but then he says to this guy, "Take your mat and walk," which in this culture would have basically been, "All right, sir, go and sin." And that's how it was looked at. This was looked at as a sin to basically take up the mat and walk. You're not supposed to carry anything for a certain distance. What in the world? And so Jesus says to him, "Okay, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to heal you now. Take up your mat and go ahead and walk in this area of sin." I'm convinced that this was a setup that Jesus had to have this interaction with the Jewish leaders. So here it says, and so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat. You can't do what it is that you're doing." And look at how the man responds. He said, but he replied, he said, "Wait. It's not me. It's this idea of casting blame. Mothers, you have children. You've experienced this, okay? Let's say something has been painted in your house that was not supposed to be painted. Perhaps the carpet, okay? Why are you painting the carpet? Well, my brother told me to paint the carpet, okay? It's kind of one of those things. So you were painting the carpet. You're not supposed to be painting the carpet. Why are you painting the carpet? My brother told me to do it. So it's his fault, really, that you're the one painting the carpet." This is the idea of casting blame. And so what this man says, okay, the man who made me well, there's this guy, he healed me. Well, I'm carrying the mat because he told me to do it. And then in verse 12, it says, "Who is this fellow?" So these Jewish leaders say, they want to know, all right, who's going around and telling people to disobey the law? We want to know, what's the deal here? Who is going around telling you to pick up your mat and walk? And he says, "Who is this fellow that told you to pick up the mat and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was. Remember a couple weeks ago when we talked about it, this invalid had no faith. He did not know who Jesus was. He did not have great faith saying, "Jesus, I know who you are. I believe that you're the Son of Man. I want you to heal me." None of that. And yet we see Jesus do this amazing healing with many other people around. We don't understand in some capacities why Jesus healed him and not others. But there's obviously something, again, we talked about this. When Jesus heals someone, he does it with intentionality. He does it with purpose for a very specific reason, that it's to point back to himself. It's used to draw other people into belief in him. You know, he doesn't just heal randomly. Is of purpose. And so he heals this invalid knowing full well that this is going to bring out an opportunity by which he can share the gospel and bring other people to him. So the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd after he had healed him. Verse 14. Later, so Jesus finds this guy at the temple. So this man carrying the mat, the Jewish leaders confront him. Who is it that told you to pick up? I have no idea who the guy was. Well, Jesus finds this man later up at the temple. And this is the interaction. He says, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you." This is just, I want you to grasp this picture here. Now, Jesus has just healed someone who has no faith. He has healed someone who is a sinner. We don't know what he was involved in. You know, Jesus heals all kinds of sinners. Okay, don't take that as being the main point. But what Jesus is really saying here is, you were where you were at because of the sin in your life. That's not always the case. You look at here in John chapter 9, verse 1. All right? Just because you're suffering from an ailment, I want to be very clear, does not mean that you're living a life of sin. It's not punishment. All right? Now, sometimes there are consequences for our sins that could be physical ailments. That happens, okay? And so we have a contrast here. I just want to be clear. So in John chapter 9, we'll get to this in a few weeks, it says in verse 1, he says, as he went, this is Jesus, he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked Jesus, he says, "Rabbi, who sinned?" Now, this is following this interaction of Bethsaida. Who sinned that this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus responds, he says, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that," here it is, this is the point, this is the purpose, this is why Jesus does what he does, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." So I want you to grasp, I want you to understand, all right? When Jesus heals and what the things that he does, they're very specific. They're for a reason, and they're to bring glory to him. They're to bring other people into belief in him. So I want you to kind of grasp where we're going with that. The man went away. This is back to John chapter 5, verse 15. The man went away. He'd been at the temple. He encountered Jesus. He recognized that this is the guy that healed me. All right? And Jesus says to this man, "I see that you are well." In other words, remember, I healed you. He says, "I see that you are well. Go and sin no more." And this is the guy's response. And he goes and told the Jewish leaders. He basically goes and rats Jesus out. Now he knows who healed him. So instead of saying, "Boy, thank you for that. Show me how I can have belief in you," instead he turns away and goes back to the Jewish leaders and says, "Hey, I know who it was that told me to take up my mat and walk. Okay? I know who it is now. Remember that when you got mad at me for carrying my mat? Well, it wasn't really my fault. It was this Jesus fellow. Okay? He's the one that healed me. He's the one that told me to take up my mat and walk." And so he goes and he rats Jesus out. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. And this is really the first incident that we have where it talks about the Jewish leaders intentionally trying to persecute. We don't know what this persecution looks like. But Jesus does something here on what has appeared to be this day of supposed rest. And he does something that appears to the Jewish leaders as, "Hey, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's work. And you caused other people to do work. And that's forbidden. We can't have that." This is a big deal. And so I want to look back. This is in Exodus chapter 20. This is where this idea, what the Jewish leaders are coming at it from. So back in Exodus, you remember when we dealt with the Israelites. They've been brought out of Egypt. They were in slavery in Egypt for 400 years. And then Moses comes along, and God speaks to Moses through that burning bush, and then he leads Moses to go back into Egypt. He had been raised in Egypt. He goes back into Egypt, and his job is to bring his people, God's people, out of Egypt. And so there's this 10 plagues, and all of this stuff happens. And they get to this point where suddenly now they have fled Egypt. They've gone through the Red Sea, and now they're out into the wilderness. And in this process, God is leading them with a pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud. And they come to this base of Mount Sinai. And Moses goes up the mountain and God is giving Moses these rules and these commandments. And this is what it says. It says, "Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy." That means basically keeping the idea of it set apart, the idea of holy. "6 days you shall labor and do all of your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals." In other words, your animals, you're not supposed to be burdening them with the plow and having them carry things. I mean, this is supposed to be done. "Nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day." Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. God didn't rest on that seventh day because he was tired. But I do believe he points us to a couple of things. This is what I really want you to grasp this morning, because we're dealing with this idea of rest. And we're going to see it in a couple of levels. We're going to see it physical, but even more than that, I want you to grab the spiritual aspect of what it looks like to find rest. So what God did is he worked for 6 days and he rested on the seventh, and he calls his people, I want you to do the same, because when they do the same thing, when they do what God has asked them to do, it points back to him. It draws other people to him. You know, what's fascinating, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I'm going to say it lest I forget to say it later. When you look at the Israelites, so what happened then, so they're at Mount Sinai, they got nothing to eat. Remember this? They oftentimes had nothing to drink, and God provided for them. Well, what happened, you remember the story, there's manna. All right, this is that bread from heaven that would come down. So each morning they would wake up and the ground was covered with manna. For year after year after year, God provided this manna for them to eat. And so in the morning they'd get up and they'd collect the manna and they would have enough manna for the day. If they took more than enough manna, by the next morning it was rotten, full of maggots, and nasty. Okay? So God provided them every day. And then it got to be the day before the Sabbath. That sixth day, and they were said, all right, now today and only today, you are asked to double it. Collect twice as much manna so that on that Sabbath, you don't have to do any work. I mean, it's not this, we look at it sometimes as this legalistic piece, and we're missing it because it is not a legalistic piece. God knows that we need rest. And so God provides them a means by which to find that rest. So what he does, he says, on that Saturday, collect twice as much. So then on that Sunday, you can just rest and trust and know that I've got you. Because you've collected all that you need on Saturday. And so that Sunday comes, you don't have to go and collect. You've got it. It's right there. And I want you to grasp this morning that kind of a rest where we just know that God's got it. And we're going to see that in some of the scriptures that we look at this morning. So back to John chapter 5. So in Jesus' defense, and this is where it gets, and we'll cover this a little bit more here next week too. So Jesus, I believe, pretty much invited this interaction between these Jewish leaders and saying, hey, what are you doing? You can't heal people on the Sabbath, and you certainly can't go and tell people to take up their mat and walk on the Sabbath. By the way, this was not part of what God had intended when we just looked at that Exodus passage. Nowhere in there did it say, don't pick up your mat and walk. It doesn't say that. This was something that was added by the Jewish leaders to kind of keep that regulatory. They have all these regulations that they lay on layer after layer after layer. Don't do this, don't do this. Because all they saw was this is a legalism. We got to make sure that we're not doing any work on that Sabbath. You pick up your mat, well, technically that's work. So they had these rules. So if they had, they wouldn't take up a mat, but if they had anything to carry, they were allowed to carry something for like 5 feet. And that would be about it. There you're done. Okay, that's all the steps you can take on the Sabbath. You can't take any more. If you take one more step, it's considered work. And so they had all of these rules and regulations. And what's fascinating is what God had intended to bring rest to the people, you know, this idea of have this day of rest, became a burden. It was work to keep the Sabbath. Do you follow that? I mean, it's just, it became this like heaviness that these Jewish leaders would bring upon the people. It's this heaviness of the Sabbath. Oh man, I hope I don't take too many steps. Oh man, what if I miscounted? Now I'm going to be in trouble. And there was, instead of finding rest, they found burden in trying to keep the Sabbath. And that is not what God intended whatsoever. And so Jesus, in his defense, Jesus says to them, he says, my Father is always working. This is very in-your-face comment. He said, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working. The sequence of Jesus' words are equating himself and saying, my Father, which they would have recognized, they would have called God my Father, but the language that's used here, the words that are used, basically what Jesus is contrasting. So the Jewish leaders may have said, God our Father, they never would have used it in a singular context. My, never would have happened, never. And so Jesus says, God my Father, he's differentiating, saying, I am something special. I am next to God. In other words, I am equal with God in this context. That's really what Jesus is saying. And that's pretty much these Jewish leaders saying, hey, you can't do that on the Sabbath. He says, pretty much, yeah, I can. You want to know why? Because I'm God. In a nutshell, that's what's kind of being communicated here. So Jesus says, my Father is always at work to this very day. And I too am working. In other words, if God's doing something, I'm doing something, because he and I are in this perfect relationship. Mothers, do your children ever fight? I know, right? No, our kids don't. I'm usually sleeping through it. So the children that fight, you know, it's relentless sometimes. But I want you to grasp this idea that God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit has always been in this perfect relationship. There's never been conflict between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Husbands and wives, do you have conflict once in a while? Once in a while. We call them Tuesdays. And every other day that ends in a Y, right? Okay. You have these conflicts. It exists. It's part of our human nature. However, when we look at our relationships and we contrast it with God, God's had this perfect relationship, where Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit have never had conflict. And that's difficult for us to put our minds around, but they have never had conflict. And so what he's saying is what the Father does, I do. It's natural. It goes. You know, we don't have to argue about what we're going to spend our money on. We don't have to argue about how we're going to discipline the kids. It's natural. We're always in agreement. You know, it's like the Mother's Day. You know, it's the moms. We're always in agreement with the moms. And if we're not, I'm wrong. Okay. For this reason, they tried all the more. Okay, so basically because Jesus said, I am equal to God, the Jewish leaders saying they tried all the more to kill him. Not only, get this, not only was he breaking the Sabbath, all right, that was bad enough. Remember, he did this work, he did this healing on the Sabbath. He told this guy to take his mat and walk on the Sabbath. He's leading other people astray on the Sabbath. Not only is he doing these appalling things, but now look what he's doing. But he is even calling God his own Father, that personal connection, that personal relationship, making himself equal with God. In other words, he's saying, not only is he saying, he's healing people and telling people to disobey the Sabbath. Now he's saying, I'm God. Whoa, we got to get rid of this guy. He's got to be dead. We look in Matthew. There's this is where this story comes from. Jesus is walking with his disciples. They're going through a field. It happens to be on the Sabbath. And as they're walking through this field in fellowship with his friends, he takes grain and he takes some of the grain and he eats some of the grain, and the disciples are doing the same thing. And some of these Jewish leaders see him doing that and they're calling him on that. Seriously, do you ever not work on the Sabbath? Because that, again, you weren't allowed to harvest grain on the Sabbath, and they're looking at that as like, what is wrong with you, Jesus? Don't you know the law? Why would you keep doing that? But I think even in the midst of this experience with Jesus walking in the field with his disciples, you can see this picture of fellowship. You can see this picture of rest. You know, you're going to go home today, and it's a Sabbath, if you will. We're going to go home today, and I hope that you're going to honor your mothers. But in this process, whether it was Mother's Day, whether it was a different day, you're going to go home, and you're going to have to eat something, and you're going to prepare yourself something to eat. You know, and sometimes we look at that, let's work. And yes, there's work around it. I get that. And there's work in the idea of cleaning it up. Okay, not our house. I can wait till tomorrow. But there's the idea of cleaning it up. But even in the midst of that, there's that relationship. You can find rest in the relationship. I don't know if you're grasping that. We'll continue on here, and maybe it'll make it a little bit more clear. But in this Matthew 12, and so Jesus says to him, if you had known, he tells us to the Jewish leaders, if you had known what these words mean, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice. The Jewish leaders, all they really cared about, you have to do it this way, you have to do it this way. And Jesus is saying, you're missing it. You're just absolutely missing it. And he goes on, I don't desire your legalistic obedience. You know, instead he says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. You would not have condemned the innocent. In other words, you wouldn't have condemned these men for picking grain and eating as they're going through this field. You would not have condemned the innocent, for the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And there he comes out and says, you're missing it. I created the Sabbath. I know what the Sabbath is and what the Sabbath isn't. And it's intended to bring rest to my people, not the burden that you're laying on them. In Hebrews chapter 4, we're going to cover a few verses here, but this is where we switch, and this is where we kind of transition, we're going to shift gears. In Hebrews chapter 4, verse 1, it says, therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you will be found to have fallen short of it. You know how it is when you go through your week. You know, you have jobs. Oftentimes, very, very few of us will ever work 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, except you, Brody, right? Very seldom there's no one that really does that. And in the meantime, what ends up happening is we end up working our work week, whether it's a five-day week or a six-day week, and we find ourselves longing for and looking towards that next day off, right? You know, so we're at the school week. You know, students, you're almost done. You're almost done with another year. Parents, you're squirming because you know what comes with summer break, just chaos and mess and stress. And the first thing that's going to come out of their mouth in the week one is, I'm bored, there's nothing to do. Go back to school. Seriously. But there's this idea, we long for this idea of rest that's always in the future. You know, we look to the weekend, it's like, oh, I can't wait till Saturday because then finally I won't have to go to work and I'll find this rest that I've been looking for. And then Saturday comes, Saturday goes, and we find ourselves there back on Monday morning and we're just as stressed out. We're not finding any kind of a permanent rest. And we live it for that week by week, looking for that day by day. Sometimes it's in the summers, especially in Minnesota. That's when our vacations are. And so we look forward to these weeks of vacation that we're going to take. Oh, I can't wait till this week of vacation. I can't wait till the summer break for you students, because then finally I will have rest. And then you find that the once your summer break has hit, students, you hit summer break and you find out that mom and dad have all kind of chores for you to do, and it's not the rest that you expected to have happen. And you're always looking for rest. You never seem to find it. Rest always eludes us, you know? It's one of those things that's always coming. It's that promise for rest is always coming, but it never seems to arrive because there's always something else that comes up. You know, you can have a work week. Maybe you have a week off. You're staying at home, and your job is done for the year if you're a school teacher, and now you're looking at your week. It's like, wow, I've got all this time on my hands, and yet what you find is it is totally filled up with more and more stuff. I've heard it said from different people who have retired, all right? The rest, it didn't really come, you know? There's all kinds of things that start pulling you in other directions, and you're still longing for rest. So whatever age you're at, whether you're young looking for summer break, whether you're middle age looking for that weekend, whether you have retired, you're always looking for this rest that is promised out there, and it never really arrives. I'm convinced that God has something else in mind. I think that maybe then we're looking at the wrong idea of what rest is. I do think fully that when we look at the scriptures and how God took the Israelites and he gave them that day of rest, there was something there, something in the concrete where they could find that physical rest. And I think physical rest is important, but I think there's something much deeper going on than just this idea of physical rest. It's this idea of spiritual rest. I want you to look at in Exodus chapter 33. Again, Old Testament. This is that same genre of when these people are wandering in the wilderness. The Lord says to them, this is just before they're going to enter into this land of Canaan. That was their promised land of rest. When they get into this promised land of rest, when they cross over that Jordan River, and they're going to go into this land of rest, do you think that they're suddenly now going to sit idle? Is their physical rest permanent? It's not. They're still going to have work to do. So there's something else then that we're missing with this idea. And so this is what God is saying to them. He said, the Lord replied, he said, my presence, as you go into the land of Canaan, my presence will go with you, and I'm going to give you rest. This is a nation that came out of 400 years of slavery. Now all of a sudden they're not going to be working for someone else. They're going to be doing the work for themselves. And in the midst of that, they're going to find rest. And this is how I believe they're going to find rest. Because they're going to learn to find contentment. They're going to learn to find trust in who God is. And that, my friends, is where we can find rest. Because as you're looking for that weekend, you're looking for this time of rest, you're not going to find the rest that we're really looking for our souls. Where we find rest is having this confidence, okay, my life's a wreck. But God's bigger than my circumstances. And I can trust him. And that's where I'm going to find some rest, is when you learn to trust him, even when things seem totally out of control. Moms, I am so sorry for how your husbands and children have treated the home that you work at to keep nice and tidy. And mostly comes from me, okay? And I'm making the generalization that it's true for all of us. But I am so sorry for the way that it gets wrecked, because what that does, in a sense, is it causes all of the work, this idea of rest for the mom, this idea of rest coming, it's like it never can happen. It never comes. It's always this rest that's always eluding us. It's always in the future. If I can just get this cleaned, if I can just get this done. And then what you find is it's just been totally undone throughout that process and you find no rest. But I want to challenge you. I want you to find a time to say, okay, God, I can't do this. I need you to help me find rest. So I don't have a tool belt that has feather dusters, you know, and or Windex. If I did, I would have worn it. But so here, this is kind of the idea. So we go through our life, all right, and we work because that's what we've been called to do, and that's good and that's right. And so I have my tools that I have in order to do the work that I need to do. And so I walk around. All right, there's something that needs to be hammered, and so you pull out the hammer and you're going to whack whatever needs to be hammered. Maybe it's the gopher, maybe it's a nail that's sticking out. But either way, you have the tool that you need to do it, and so you go through life and you work. But what ends up happening? Okay, so I have the day of rest, and what I end up doing is I take my tool belt. It's my day of rest. And I take and I sit down and I keep my tool belt right with me. You know what I mean? Because I've got something else needs to be done. Well, I hop right up and I'm going to grab my hammer again. I'm going to whack a chipmunk this time that got into the house. Okay. So I always have it with me. But what we don't do is say, okay, God, I feel like I really have a lot of things to do, and I just can't set down the tools. But I think that's kind of what this idea is. We need to set down the tools and be able to say, all right, I want to trust you that it's going to be okay. All right, I don't like to live in a certain way. I don't like to live with things broken. I feel like I have this responsibility that I have to go. And so what ends up happening then is we sit. And this picture of the Sabbath is when we can sit and envision, if you would, you know, I'll tell you the story. This last week, we were at one of the elementary school track and field meets. Basically, it's chaos day. That's what ends up happening. So you go to the elementary track and field meets, and kids are running around everywhere, all right? But in the process, so you learn as you've gone through enough of these, you bring these camping chairs, and you sit down in this camping chair. Well, we had some friends that were there, and they had a little girl. She's 16 months old, I think. And she comes up to me, and I hardly know this girl. And she comes up to me and she hops up into my lap and she just nestles in and snuggles in. And so I just sat there and holding her. And it's this picture. That's rest. And that's what we don't get. Moms, that's what you don't find. You know, as we work, we feel like I've got to work. I can't trust God to take care of this situation because I have a responsibility that I have to do. And sometimes we need to set aside the tool belt, crawl up into God's lap and say, God, I have all this stuff to do. I'm not finding any rest. And we crawl up in his arms and we say, but I want to trust you. I want to find your trust. I want to be confident that you've got this. And God sits there and he wraps his arms around us. He says, yeah, rest. And that's finding rest in God. That's the kind of rest that will endure and that will last. Is when we can finally find ourselves at a point where we can come to God with this confidence, okay, God, you got to do this. Because I am running in circles and nothing else is changing. I'm working. If I take a day off, the house gets trashed. If I take a day off, what if I can't pay for this? And we find ourselves working and working and working for things that God never intended for us to have. You know, parenting for moms, I mean, it's difficult. You know, when you have those young babies, there's challenges when you have the young babies, right? You got crying, you got to figure out why they need to be, why are they crying, what needs to happen. And so you have to feed them, you have to change the diapers. And then you always kind of have this foresight, it's always going to get easier. Once they can start, you know, using the potty, then life will be a little bit easier. You know, once they can brush their own teeth, once they can bathe themselves, once they can feed themselves, once they can dress themselves or tie their own shoes or put their own stuff away, there's always this promise of rest in the future, but there's always something else that comes and robs us of the rest. There's this picture. You know what this craze, this rage, this fidget spinners? You seen those? If I had one, I'd bring it. I don't have one. So it's this little bearing thing, okay? You take it, you hold it in your fingers, and you spin it. And it just spins. That's pretty much what it does. And sometimes you can hop it from finger to finger, you know. It's like a yo-yo that's stuck to your head. Hey, you got one. Dave's got one. He's hip. That's right. Are you going to bring it to me? Thanks, Judah.
Thank you.
All right, here's a fidget spinner. Okay? That's what it does. It spins. It was designed, apparently, to help children focus in school. I know. I know, right? Who in the world thought that was a good idea? I don't know. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, teachers are not liking fidget spinners, just so you know. That's not working. The intent was not working. That has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. But there's the idea. So Isaac was really wanting one of these, and he's got one. But what ended up happening is he made all these calls around town, and he kept calling these places, do you have them, do you have them? And everyone was sold out. Finally, Walgreens has one. So he comes up to me, I was working in the garage. He says, Dad, Walgreens has them. We got to go now. And I gave him a few minutes, and I was like, ah, whatever. You know, like they're going to run out. It's close. Anyway, so I took my own sweet time, and then, I know you just can't help but spin it. Can't just stand up here and keep spinning it. Yeah, you can see what teachers are driven crazy by it. Anyway, so Isaac wants it, so I finally, we get ready, the kids got loaded up in the van, and we drive to Walgreens, and wouldn't you know it, I've got three kids with me, they had three left. They sold out in like 3 hours. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is, yeah, that has nothing to do with anything we're talking about. The point of the story is this. A couple of days before we actually scored one of these, Isaac wanted to go to Walgreens to check. And so we're sitting in the parking lot, and I said, okay, Isaac, you got to go in and ask. He said, I don't want to go in and ask. He says, well, I'm not. Why would I go in and ask? He says, you're the one that wants it. He says, well, because, you know, if I go in and ask, they're going to go in and they're going to say, where's your parents? Why are you in here by yourself? And so what ended up happening is I went in with them. You know, and nothing changed. But there's this picture of, Dad, I'm okay going in. I'm okay asking. But I want to know that you're with me on that. You know, it's something silly. But the picture of it is the same when we look at God. And we're looking and trying to find that rest. And sometimes what we really need to do is slow down and say, all right, God, I just need to know that you're with me. And when we know that God is with us, that's where we're going to find that rest. In all circumstances and all the troubles that we face, that's where we're going to find our rest. I am convinced that our culture, not just our church, not our community, but our culture in North America, we do not rest well. We base so much of our confidence in what it is that we can do. And so we rely so heavily upon ourselves that I will not let go of the tool belt. Because that is my security. That is where my confidence is. It's in my ability. And we totally lose focus on really where we're going to find that rest. You know, so we work and we work and we work, trying and trying and trying to find that opportunity. If I get enough done, then I can find some rest. And it just never comes. My prayer for you, as you can find such a confidence that God's got you, that you can find that rest that everyone in this culture is longing for. And that when you find that rest, you find that confidence, and someone looks at you and says, how can you be so peaceful? How can you be so much at rest? You can say, yeah, I'll tell you why. I used to battle. I used to struggle. And I let me tell you, I found Jesus has given me that rest. How can that be? Because I found such a confidence in him. He takes care of everything that I need. Does that mean you're going to have a big boat and a big house? No, not at all. You're missing it if that's what you're after. It's not this kind of prosperity type stuff. It's a soul confidence that God's got you, even in the midst of all of your struggle. I'm going to invite Dave and the worship team to come up. And we're going to sing that new song again as we wrap up. And I want you to prayerfully be singing these words and looking at the message in this song, because it is all about us finding that soul rest that we are longing to have.